Hey everyone, welcome to Alumless. It is Friday, March the 15th. Hope you're having a great day. Thank you for joining us. I lied just a little bit. It is not Friday the 15th for us. It's actually Monday the 11th. We are recording this ahead of time this week. Chris is at Rollins College in Florida. He's got alumni weekend. Did I say that right, Chris? Alumni weekend? That's what you said.
It's actually next week, but all the planning is happening this week. So.
Yeah. And you've got Disney coming up. So you've got a big week plus some family travel. So we're like, you know what? We're going to tackle this episode in advance and let you and the family and alumni weekend do their thing. But we're grateful for those of you who are joining us live. Hope that you'll pick up the podcast edition of Alumless as well. We've got a great show today featuring our colleague, Nicole Kempton. We're going to bring her out in just a couple of minutes. If you have any questions for Chris or myself or Nicole or just want to say hello, we will check the chat of the LinkedIn event. So if you have any questions or just want to say hello, we would be grateful to comment on those in due course. Of course, pick up the podcast edition in order to listen to the bonus section of Alumless with each of our guests, including our Friday Cheer section where we try to comment on some other things that may not be exclusively advancement related. And of course, we would not be able to produce Alumless without our fantastic sponsoring partner, Protopia. Protopia has created a transformational AI-powered technology that matches questions from students or recent grads with alumni all over the world that are perfectly positioned to answer them without asking alums to be mentors and participate in programs spread over months or sign up for an app or platform, Protopia makes scaling introductions simple. Questions get submitted and Protopia's AI does all the work. Protopia can even target stakeholders like young alumni or lapsed donors and provide them with a meaningful volunteer experience. And who isn't trying to scale volunteerism? Visit protopia.co/alumless for more details and to check out the technology that schools like Duke, Denison, Florida State, and the London School of Economics are all using to find to make alumni networks available for their stakeholders. All right, Chris, back in the saddle. It's good to see you.
You too. Morning.
You're in your home away from home there at Rollins. I feel like every time I shoot a text to you, I'm at the Orlando airport. You know? I'm on my way to Orlando. You've been working.
This is trip 11.
Yeah,
or 12. With this trip in the last 5 months, so I've been here a lot.
And of course, you know, you've had the chance to get to know Rollins intimately, to say the least. You know, but we as consultants, we're always trying to get to know each of our clients, what makes them unique, what are their core values, personality traits. We use the phrase secret sauce often when we're kind of describing how to get to know each of our clients. Can you talk a little bit about how we try to do that in our work, try to get to know each of our partners uniquely?
There is a great deal of unseen work that goes on before any project. I know you do a ton of online research yourself through their websites, but all the digital platforms and looking at communications. We actually asked each client for a set of materials that they deliver to us, which has plans and reports and demographics, snapshots of their alumni population and on and on and on. So there's dozens of pages of materials we read. The data is especially important to me is how their alumni sort of shake out across the spectrum, you know, by class year or by decade and by region, male, female, and diversity statistics. Every way we can slice it, we look at it so we know the population. And then, you know, the other one that happens over time is exactly that time. Like Rollins, I mean, I've been here so much that I know this place, and they're hiring an executive director. And when I'm talking to candidates, we're down to a final four candidates who will replace me. I'll be out of here. But I can talk to them, you know, with accuracy and sincerity about the DNA of this place. So it's one of the things we pride ourselves on is that we really get to know the institution and apply our work specifically to how that institution, you know, sort of operates and where they are in their evolutionary history.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite parts about our work is really getting to know each institution uniquely, the documentation we ask for, the website research you recommended. And it is a little different. I think Krista was at the age where, you know, part of the gig was actually to go to the place and spend a few days like interviewing people. And do you think we can still get, even if we're doing a lot of the work over Zoom, do you think we still get a pretty good accurate picture of what makes each university unique?
It's harder remote, but I'll tell you, the pandemic taught us that it's certainly more efficient and cost effective, frankly. So, you know, through the interviews that we do, I actually believe that one-on-one interviews are as just effective over Zoom as they are in person. You miss out on the in-between meeting stuff, the walking across campus, seeing the signs and talking to students, but you still, you get pretty close to the same result from a one-on-one interview, whether it's in person or remote. So I think that's a big help. We do a lot of focus group work. You and I just finished a large listening tour where we're hearing directly from alums. I mean, they're giving us feedback. In the case of the one institution we worked with, we had 149 alums speak to us and fill out a survey right online. And speaking of surveys, we do surveys, extensive, you know, scientifically researched surveys where we're looking at attitudes, engagements, and communications and other ways that the alums. So I think we can do it through the means we have. If we could, you know, wave a wand and be everywhere we need to be in person, but all of us have lives and there's real costs associated with us traveling.
Right.
But I do think we make up for it in the way we've done the background work coming into any client.
Yeah, it definitely decreases the cost for our partners, right? To not 100%. Have us there in person. And I feel like I've only done it this way since the pandemic. Yeah. And I feel like I get to know the universities pretty well. But when you think about how we write engagement strategies, how we make recommendations, or as you think about how, you know, universities in our space are devising their own strategies, do you think we put enough time thinking about what it is that alumni, donors, families, fans, all the constituent groups really want?
I'm hoping that the answer is a definitive yes. And our clients would all say that about our work. And otherwise, we're going to be in big trouble. But I think through those means we just talked about. So the interviews, listening tours, focus groups, informal and very formal scientific surveys, I think we're getting a great deal of input that allows us to make recommendations that are, I always use the word bespoke, that it has to be customized to that institution. Otherwise, what we do at one place is not going to apply to the next. And it's going to depend on so many. We talked about this in our last show, actually. The factors being things like how long have they had an alumni program and how big is the staff and how much budget are they spending? All those things are real. And you have to think about all of those factors in when you make a recommendation and factor in, constituent input, call it, broadly speaking, constituent input.
Yeah. And I think, we'll bring Nicole out here in a sec, but one of the interesting things about our work is when you ask alumni what they want, the answer is yes. yes, more campus events. Yes, more mentoring. Yes, more regional events. Yes, you name it, we want it. But I think, over the surveys tell us what they really want to know. They want to know about it.
Right. Exactly. Right?
Even if they can't come to it, right? They've definitely
They don't need to come. They just need to know that it happened, right?
They were invited,
Just about every survey we've done, the alums will say, we want lifelong learning or some format of that, right? And then you hold these great programs and it's crickets. But the places that do it well have figured out how to make those things work. And then making other people aware of that they were going on is the trick, I think, in this whole thing.
All right. Well, let's bring out Nicole. Yeah. She's got lots of great, not only interest in this area, but a lot of experience. And she's our colleague, too. Hey, Nicole, how's it going?
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We're grateful that you're here, that you're part of the CMAC team. Nicole Kempton is a CMAC vice president and senior consultant. Nicole lives in London, or at least near London, right? Kind of in the London suburbs.
Yeah.
And she works with her alma mater part-time at Duke University, as well as doing projects with us, the CMAC team, and is really our tour de force over in Europe. And at this moment, I think you're on vacation in Copenhagen. Did I hear you say that? In Denmark?
Yeah. Well, I'm digital nomading this week. So I am working, but I'm working from a different place. So
it's one of the beautiful things about the world we live in now is the digital nomading thing is an awesome opportunity particularly for folks in the type of work that we do. But yeah. Nicole, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'm not the only one who had the same idea, because there's a coffee shop downstairs in my hotel and it's absolutely full of laptops and people typing away. So I'm in good company.
I think it sounds like the right thing to be doing. When we were prepping for our show, Nicole, we were talking about the idea of constituent-centered engagement strategies. And I thought, you know, we often talk about donor-centered engagement strategies, and that's a term I think that's been around a little while. We use the phrase constituent-centered a little bit less. But what, maybe we'll just start off, what does that mean to you? What does that mean in general?
Yeah, so constituent to me is a great term because it encompasses alums, it encompasses donors, parents, supporters, students, other colleagues. And so it can really just mean the people that you're serving versus that I like the term donor-centric too, but in our work, especially as we're trying to go towards more of an integrated advancement model, I think constituent-centered is a little bit more inclusive and also allows us to think about different audiences for different purposes. And so what I mean when I say constituent-centered is just being relentlessly focused on the constituent in everything that you do. And so that means designing your program around the needs of the constituent. And how do we do that? Well, we have to really understand our constituent in order to do that effectively, right? And Chris, you and Chris talked a little bit about our research approach to getting to know an institution. And I think my favorite approach to being constituent-centered is design thinking. And so most of your listeners have probably heard the term design thinking or human-centered design, as it's sometimes called. And this is a process, an approach to solving challenges and problems that puts the customer, or in our case, the constituent, at the center. And you can use this approach to design products or to design services, but it involves a five-step process. And I'm going to run through the steps really fast because I think they're actually quite critical to understanding what this is and why it's important. And the first one is to empathize. And so this is where you conduct research to better understand your constituents. We talked about that a little bit already. The second part is defining the problem. And so you take what you learned in the discovery process and you really hone in on what are the user's pain points. And the third part of the process is ideation. And so this is where you use divergent thinking. So that means, you know, you're getting super creative. There's no bad ideas. We generate lots of ideas to solve that problem. And then we go into the fourth step, which is prototyping. And so this is where we actually think about a potential solution to the problem. And then in the fifth part, we test it. And so we take that prototype out into the real world and we test it with our constituents. And this is a really highly iterative process. And so that means that you might cycle back through any or all of these steps multiple times before you actually find something that works. But what I love about it is that it's sort of where, you know, our ideas meet the real world. And so hopefully, you know, by going through this kind of rigorous process, you end up with something in the end that's more sustainable and actually meets the constituents' needs. So
yeah. I can think of a couple times in my career that I went through those steps in order to kind of devise a new program. And I have to admit it doesn't necessarily mean you'll be successful with it, because I still think you're taking some risks in order to try new things. But I wanted to ask you sort of your thoughts about the attributes of an organization that has really figured out what it means to be constituent-centered. What does that look like? And is the opposite approach of that like university-centered, right? I mean, sort of doing what it is that the university wants alumni to do versus the converse. I mean, the university wants alumni to engage in order to provide assistance when it comes to enrollment or retention, career outcomes, and of course, philanthropy. But yeah, what is successful constituent-centered university work look like?
Yeah, so I think I'll go to the second part first and then work my way back, like go to what not to do and then kind of work my way back to what to do. And I think we make a lot of assumptions, right, about our alums. And I think we're all guilty of doing it. And we think about like, what are our priorities and how can we get our alums to do what we want them to do? Right. And I guess I would say, you know, what we're not necessarily thinking about when we do that is what do their lives actually look like and how are we solving problems for them? How are we serving them? And, you know, when we think about like how to incentivize people to give back, I know there's one study that I think it's the Christensen Institute that published it originally. I should have looked it up before this call, but where the biggest predictor of future engagement with the institution is whether a student had a mentoring relationship with an adult during their time on campus, right? And ideally an alum. They automatically, the student who benefits from that relationship automatically tends to give back after they leave the institution. You asked about attributes of organizations that have figured this out. And I think one big thing that I would say is having a learning mindset as an organization and putting curiosity first and really thinking about how can you as a leader create a culture of curiosity within your team. And I think on the last podcast with Cheryl Harrelson, which was terrific, you talked about when you're a leader and you're transitioning from one organization to another and the importance of learning the culture in that place. And I think that that's not just important to do when you're new, but just something that you should be doing continuously. And I think if you can create that culture on your team, you know, you're going to have, you're going to be like listening more to what your constituents want and what they need. And you're going to be kind of putting that mindset first when you design new programs and new initiatives. And I think what I'll say on a very personal note is that I think having that curiosity mindset has really served me well in my career because, it helps you develop empathy. And, I think that's key to kind of navigating some of the politics and territoriality that tend to crop up in the university environment. You know, it's this highly matrixed, highly decentralized place. And, you have to sort of ask yourself, why, why is the person that I'm dealing with, why do they think this way? And how might they have come to believe this particular thing that they believe? And I think when you ask yourself why, suddenly that kind of puts you in their shoes and helps you kind of figure out, how to more effectively work together. And so, I just think that in terms of the thing that organizations can do when they're constituent centered, it's about thinking about the alum and what do they need and how can we help them. But it's also thinking about your campus colleagues as constituents too. And how can you meet their needs? How can you be serving them more effectively? So yeah, I think it's all of the above.
Sorry about that. I want to step us back a second. People know on these podcasts that we do some prep and we do a little bit of research in the background so that we know what we're talking about. And one of the stories you shared with us was about specifically two examples of design thinking. Mm-hmm. One outside the field, this is the Stanford Design School students in Nepal. And then the other one more in our field. But would you mind sharing those quickly, those two stories, and then I'll have a follow-up, but I think these are good examples for folks to kind of get their head around this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, thanks for asking that. Cause I asked if I could share two, one completely unrelated to
a lot. I love it. I love it. So fire away.
Because I think this illustrates really the power of design thinking to save lives. And so in 2015, students from the Stanford Design School were asked to design a better incubator for babies in Nepal. And so they were thinking, you know, we're going to design a machine that's cheaper and, more easy to operate. And they got to Nepal on their research trip, and they got to the hospital and they saw, well, they have incubators. They're just all empty. And why are they empty? And so they realized that the issue was that a lot of parents who have premature babies, they live very far from a hospital. They're not able to actually make it to the hospital in time. So you can have the best incubator in the world, but it doesn't make a difference for those people. And so they kind of completely changed their approach. And they said, okay, actually, our constituent is parents of premature babies who live far away from hospitals. And they ended up designing this little mini sleeping bag called the Embrace that costs $25. It can be heated in a pot of boiling water, and it can obviously be distributed much more easily in the rural, more undeveloped environment than an incubation machine can. And so, that design thinking project has saved a lot of lives. And I think just really illustrates the importance of knowing your constituent and also understanding what's the right pain point that you're trying to solve. Yeah. Right. Sure. And then in closer to home in the alumni world, I think our sponsor Protopia is a fantastic example of a company that uses design thinking all the time to solve problems for their users. And so, Protopia just, they recognize that like students really want mentoring, right? But they usually are not a huge fan of these structured mentoring programs. They tend to kind of like drop off over time. Most of the time when they say they want mentoring, they mean they want just-in-time advice to something that they're dealing with. And for alums, they really want to help. But again, this like high commitment volunteer opportunity might not be the right thing for them. And they want to be able to say yes when they have time, and they want to be able to say no when they don't. And for advancement staff, I think, we know that we need technology to create alumni and student connections at scale. But the idea of, making alums sign up for another platform and building a profile and integrating another app into your database and everything.
Authenticating with a password.
the whole, it just like immediately seems like a huge headache, right? And so, they've kind of smoothed over a lot of those pain points, and they use this combination of design thinking and behavioral science to keep improving the product. The product is kind of changing all the time. So I just think that's a really great example of a company that's leveraging this approach in our space.
And you would know too, right? Max and the team at Protopia worked with you and the team at Duke. I think Duke was the first Protopia client. And so the next question was about, how have you worked with the team at Duke to be thinking about the important philosophy of being constituent-centered and keeping that front and center? Obviously, that work integrating Protopia was perhaps part of that work. But what are your thoughts there? How do you sort of working with Duke and helping to keep that idea front and center?
Yeah, so I think I'm biased towards Protopia because I was part of the team that brought Protopia to Duke. But I think there's a number of places where I guess it occurred to me that, we need to be thinking more about our constituents. I think, most recently I was chief of staff, but prior to leaving to travel around the world with my family. But in my previous roles, I started out at the business school, and then I moved into a role overseeing graduate and professional school engagement. And I used to hear people say things like, oh, the business school does its own thing, or, oh, like graduate alumni, PhD alumni, they're not really interested in engaging with Duke. And when I actually went out, I embarked on this huge stakeholder interview process when I started the grad and professional school engagement role. And I realized that that wasn't the case at all, right? But what was true was that we were definitely not meeting the graduate alumni needs, right? And in fact, some of the communication that we were pushing out to them and some of the opportunities that we were pushing out to them actually were turning them off of engaging with Duke. And so we had to think about, okay, like, how do we change our approach to be more one Duke and less focused exclusively on the undergrad experience? And this is something that is like an existential problem for us because the listeners may or may not know this, but the Duke alumni population now is majority grad and professional school alums. And so if we're not doing a really good job of engaging those alums, then, you know, we have a real problem on our hands, right? And so I think, you know, there have been a lot of cases where we've used, you know, design thinking or a design thinking light approach to thinking about how do you engage different populations that have historically been underserved by the university.
Chris, you know, we're bumping up against the top of the show here, but I wanted to ask you, you know, Nicole joined our team back in December. I think that's right. Nicole, was it earlier than that? Time flies by, but
I was trying to think. It's late
fall, right?
November, yeah.
Say Thanksgiving,
right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. But I wanted to ask, how did you meet Nicole, Chris? And obviously, you know, what was sort of your thinking when you wanted to add Nicole to the team? Just letting viewers know a little bit more about how that came to be.
In any project that we do, we get to know the client. And I've been doing work with Duke for, I think, 3 strategic plans over 6-7 years. And I saw Nicole in the grad school, the business role. I saw her move into the central role with working with all grad professionals. And then move through those ranks very quickly and then become the chief of staff of all of advancement for Dave Kennedy, the VP. And all along, it was clear that there was this smart cookie underneath all the work that was within the great group of people, that there was this really shining star person, and it was Nicole, obviously. And we got to work very closely on during the pandemic on what we call then the change management team. So we were on weekly, hour-long, how do we deal with this issue discussions. And I just even got further into knowing Nicole and how smart and how her brain works and how she approaches things. So it was a no-brainer. We have the exact kinds of problems that clients need solutions to with her approach. So it was an easy ask to have her join the team. So I'm thrilled you're with us, Nicole. Thanks for
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm blushing.
Wicked smart, I always tell people.
Well, we'll pick up the conversation with Nicole and keep the conversation going in our bonus segment. But Chris, before we do that, who are we featuring in 2 weeks?
Sue Ballard, now at RPI, was formerly at Syracuse, and she's fantastic. Another great leader in the space. She's in kind of it's kind of a chief of staff role, thinking about how all the parts come together. Very strategic, very much like Nicole in that way. And I'm thrilled to talk to her about it, what she did at both Syracuse and what she's doing now at RPI. It'll be fun.
She's really a leader in the landscape when thinking about organizational effectiveness and, thinking about talent and thinking about retention of talent, recruitment, but also all the soft components of creating a great team that is highly functioning. And of course, being constituent-centered, you'd imagine to be a really important component of that. So, all right. Well, we will say goodbye. Thank you for listening live on LinkedIn or on YouTube, wherever you picked us up. And for those of you who are listening on the podcast version, we'll be back just after the break. So we'll see you soon.
Hey, listeners. Chris and I were going to record an ad discussing all the great aspects of Protopia, of which there are many, but instead we thought it would be even better to hear from one of Protopia's current partners. Here's Sally Sistar, Executive Director of Alumni Engagement at Denison University, talking about her experience with the technology. If you like what you hear, be sure to go to protopia.co/alumlus and check it out. do you see Protopia fitting into your plans? You've mentioned a few ways that I might imagine it fitting in, but what do you think?
It's a tremendous fit. Listen, I cannot tell you how excited I was when I took this job to know that they already had Protopia, right? It's a very, very smart decision. Because one, it just, you know, it with the AI technology enabled, like it takes us out of the equation, right? It is really a great tool for alumni and students to ask those questions and be connected to, you know, the top experts, right? Or the top individuals to answer those questions for them. What I've been really excited to hear about here at Denison is, you know, if that question goes to five alumni, well, all five of our graduates are answering. And then it gets into, you know, like a train of communications between them and the individual asking the question. So it's really facilitating community for us in a way that we couldn't do that ourselves if we were at the helm of trying to, you know, facilitate someone's question going to those individuals, right? It's just, it's automatic. And that's the beauty of it. The other thing I would say to you is that it is also, it's bringing people into, it's engaging alumni that may not have engaged with us in any other way, right? But they really are appreciative that, you know, they get an opportunity to help another alumni member or help a student. I can't say enough great things about what a difference maker that has been for us on the engagement level.
All right, welcome back to Alumless. This week featuring special guests, Nicole Kempton, Vice President, Senior Consultant with us at CMAC. We are fantastically thrilled to have Nicole as part of the team. Nicole, you and I have had a chance to get to know her a little bit. I look forward to our Friday mornings for me, afternoons for you, our regular reoccurring conversation. We talk about upcoming new business and our social stream and moving Chris into the new century when it comes to his digital habits and things of that nature.
We'll get in there.
I hope you don't show that last part on the clip, right?
I'll cut that clip out. Listeners, Chris was giving me the double bird behind the screen, which was appropriate. But Nicole, you recently moved to the UK not too long ago, and you were in South Korea before that. Mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned helping work with, I think your kids' independent school and rebuilding their alumni program when you were in South Korea. Mm-hmm. You're now in London, but working for Duke while you're in London. I guess I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, sharing a bit more about you, kind of your international travels. And what do you like living about London?
Well, I love it. This is my second time around living in the UK. My husband is British, and we met when we were both living in Hong Kong a long time ago. And so we've kind of traveled around a lot due to jobs and opportunities that have cropped up. And so we last lived in London about 15 years ago, but just come back this past fall, and it's great. I mean, I live in a village, a big village kind of outside of London to the southwest. And, I get to run along the Thames most days, and easy to get into the city and see all kinds of exhibitions and great theater. And, it's a fantastic place. And, I appreciate the opportunity a lot to be there. So.
I recall not too long ago, you were headed to a Tottenham game. I think you guys have, you and your family have adopted that as your team.
Yep. We've always been Spurs fans. I was actually a Tottenham fan before I met my husband. But I used to like two teams. I liked West Ham and Tottenham. And he said, you can't be both. You have to be, you have to pick one. And, for the sake of our relationship, please make that Tottenham. And so, that's kind of how I ended up being a Spurs fan. But yeah, we've been lucky enough to, to go to, you know, a ton of games in our, you know, many years of,
fandom.
Going in and out of the UK. So yeah.
It's definitely on my bucket list to get to an English Premier League game. My son Reed is a fan of Tottenham as well. And you and I have talked about that. But, you know, Chris, when I got started almost 3 years ago doing consulting work, it's hard to believe it's been that long. Time has flown by. You had some great advice for me about, you know, what it takes to be successful in doing the consulting work. Have you shared that same advice with Nicole? And I guess, you know, broadly speaking, if someone not Nicole was knocking on your door and saying, hey, what does it take to do consulting work in advancement? You know, what would you say?
I would say, don't do it. It's already too crowded in this space and not only more competition. But if you're going to do it, my advice would be to go in with a firm that's been doing it and knows, has a system, has an approach where you can learn sort of the tricks of the trade. And I do think I gave Nicole, I'll test it here and you tell me if I said these things to you or not. But I always say that you need three things to be a consultant. And both of you bring all three, but the third one is the hardest. And I've seen lots of consultants come through with number one and two and not get to three. Number one is that you need to have the content expertise and experience. You know, you just need to have done this work and have, you know, dive deep into the work and really understand how it, you know, comes to play. Being a leader at an institution somewhere or the role that you were both in, all are give you that, number one, that experience. Number two, I think it's really important you have a network and you are connected to people in the field and they know you and they know your reputation. And again, both of you came with that. Ryan a little more, Nicole a little bit less, but you still, you knew people. You've been out there and people knew you, knew your reputation. The third one, though, is always the hardest. And Ryan, you hit this one out of the park and Nicole's already chipping away at it. This is, again, where I see most consultants fail is you need to be able to sell. Close, always be closing. You know, that it sounds horrible because at the end of the day, this is a business where you are, you earn a living. And for Ryan and I, it's, you know, vital to our livelihood and our kids and our homes and our food on our table. So, but if you can't close a deal and you can't get someone to say, I love that concept, I love that approach, can you help me come put those, apply those principles here and get a deal put together and have them sign and say, okay, let's go do this. You're not going to succeed as a consultant, and no matter what firm you're with or who you know. And so closing the deal is the third one. And Ryan has picked that up. I think I told you it'll take you about 18 months and you did it in 12, Ryan. And Nicole's already out in front and ahead of you on that pace. So with some new clients in the hopper. So
that is awesome. Nicole, I hope that you are much faster than me and you bring work into CMAC and include me on your projects. That would be fantastic. I will happily jump on your tailwind. But I think that's true. And it's interesting too, because some of the outreach that you do, the relationship development that happens, you know, through just having, hey, let's stay connected. Sometimes it doesn't yield any work for years. And then it does.
You said this to me. I told you the sales cycle can be a long time. And you said, Chris, the sales cycle is like 3 years sometimes.
Nicole and I have been back and forth on a project that's kind of at the finish line. And, you know, that started like 3 years ago, in terms of those initial discussions. And it's just kind of, it's got to be the right time. And there's got to be the right internal environment. There's got to be the right need. And so,
Nicole, did anyway, I share those three things with you? Or is that the first time you heard it?
Yeah, no, you did. You did. Okay. But I think it's also goes back to our conversation that we were just having, which is being constituent centered. In our case, the constituent is the university client, and, you know, kind of understanding, I think being able to like sort of quickly get to grips with what they're about and, you know, how we can serve them is so critical, right? Because, I mean, different places have different needs. And, you know, I think about it like with my experience of moving around, living in a bunch of different countries, it's like every time you move or every time you travel, you have to sort of like land, get your bearings, figure out what, you know, how you're going to live your life there. Right. And it's kind of a similar, I think that that approach of kind of being thrown in a new situation and needing to kind of quickly get up to speed and understand the needs. That's something that you guys are doing all the time. I'm learning from you, you know, in terms of how do you effectively serve a client and getting to the point where, you know, they actually want to start a project with us. And so that's something I think that's really important.
Yeah. The other day you sent a job description for a role over in the UK that was, you know, like a maternity cover. They're like, oh, this could be kind of good. And I was like, oh, I spoke to, you know, that the woman who was the director there and a couple of years ago. And you know, it's those kinds of like looping in and like the constant like relation. You just never know. And
yeah, you never know.
Sometimes it's hard to, I found as you get busier and busier with actual projects to keep doing that. So that, you know, 6 months from now, there's more projects to do. Well, let me ask, speaking of projects, Nicole, what are the types of projects that you're most interested in? Do you kind of think of yourself as a specialist in one particular area or another?
Well, I do think that, you know, what we just talked about in the first half of, in the top of the hour with design thinking, you know, I used to, I would say, dabble with design thinking and a few projects at Duke, like I said, but I, one of my pandemic pursuits was to go and actually get a MicroMasters in design thinking from RIT. And so I decided that, you know, this is something that I really believe in. You know, I think it works really well in the alumni space. And so I wanted to get kind of more of a professional grounding in design thinking. And so I would say, you know, that's definitely, if it's something that our clients have been thinking about, but thinking about like, how do I actually implement this? That's definitely something that I can help with and that I'm excited to help with. And then I think the other piece is around like organizational design. I'm really excited for the next episode because it sounds like we're going to talk a little bit about organizational health. But, you know, it's one thing to kind of have an idea for a new initiative. And that's another thing to say like, okay, how do we actually operationalize that within our organization? And, you know, that's something that I feel like really excited to help people figure out. And so, you know, that and strategic planning, I mean, you know, I think board member engagement as well is something that I'm really passionate about. I used to be chair of the board of a nonprofit, and it's something that is very near and dear to my heart. And I really understand the challenges on a deep personal level of doing that well. And so, yeah, I think there's a whole range of things, but those are the things that I'm kind of most excited by.
Certainly feels like there's a bountiful amount of work in that particular area. I give two projects forthcoming that the client was like, please come help me, you know, redirect our board and bring it in, you know, back towards, you know, a forward posture and the Chris's adage of, you know, nose in and hands out, right? And that create that perfect sort of symbiotic relationship with the university. And well, but you're in the UK now, you've been there for a few months. What do you make of the advancement landscape there? And also maybe even a few thoughts on the landscape in South Korea, which I would imagine plenty of folks don't know too much about.
Yeah. I mean, I think I will say that I'm right now learning about what the advancement landscape is like in the UK because, it's new to me. And what I've heard from conversations that I've had so far is that, you know, the higher ed landscape in the UK is undergoing a lot of similar challenges to higher ed everywhere. But I think in the UK, you know, the funding from, I don't know how much our listeners know about the cost of education in the UK, but university used to be basically free, and it's become much more expensive in recent years. And the funding for government funding for universities has kind of declined commensurately over time. And so, you know, so the pressure on universities to engage their alumni and also to you know, to fundraise has gone up. And it's also a case of alumni relations is really, or alumni engagement is in the process of going from something that was perceived to be like party planning to something that's much more integral to the life of the institution. And so that's very, very similar to what's been happening in North America as well. As far as universities elsewhere go, I'm an alum of the University of Hong Kong. And so I can speak for, the alumni experience there, I think you have, similar kind of march towards, alumni engagement being a much more important priority for the institution. Like, HKU, I can say as an alum, has really transformed the way that they communicate with alumni in the last 10 years or so, compared to when I first graduated in 2005. I think it's something that universities all over the world are kind of reimagining the ways that they engage alumni, from the traditional in-person events, maybe have a reunion every 5 years to, how are we really involving alums in the life of the institution, all the time and, for their entire lifetime. And so that's really a fundamental shift. And what I'll say, I want to go back to your previous question. I think when we're thinking about this question of like reimagining things, that can seem really intimidating, and that's where we can help. Right. And so I think when we're thinking about how, if you're like, oh my God, I just can't, I can't pause what I'm doing to, embark on a big stakeholder interviewing project or, to really do a deep dive into my data and understand what alums want. Like that's where we can offer a lot of value, right? Because we are able to help you, partner with you to be able to do that reimagining so that, your alumni program can be more relevant in the future. So.
One of the things that we talk about at CMAC is that we, sort of a core philosophy for us is that we help clients build an integrated advancement model.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean, the short version of that is your alumni engagement program should have a role in lots of outcomes, mm-hmm. right? Recruiting students, retaining students, hiring our graduates, all that. But one of them is fundraising. What role does the alumni engagement play in advancing philanthropy and fundraising for the institution? And being unapologetic about the fact that good engagement does lead to lots of outcomes, and one of them is good fundraising. And Duke has been on a journey around this same process. I've done, like I said, 3 plans and worked over the evolutionary stage where it was, while it was in the same organizational structure, it had a very different, being careful here, very different posture from fundraising, and then slowly began to lean in. And today we have a much more integrated structure and model and approach to thinking about the work there. Talk about that journey and what do you think most important about integration at the end of the day?
Well, I think that I think when you think about the lessons learned from a process like that, right? It's to me, what came out of that process was really a fundamental understanding that a shared vision is absolutely critical, right? You've got to have a process that somehow brings in everyone in your organization because as my old colleague, Dave Connor, who you know very well, said to us, an organization only changes when every single person in the organization changes, right? And so, each individual and people, understandably, they need to come along for the journey. You can't just say, okay, we're doing this and kind of expect people to get behind it and push.
Right,
and
right.
So, I think that had I been able to sort of rewind time, I would say, okay, let's do an organization-wide strategic plan from the start, right? And let's kind of come up with that shared vision together And then think about, you know, how do you operationalize that structurally? And how do you, you know, how do you kind of give birth to the new organization in a way that, you know, honors all the work that everyone has done, but also presents this very compelling shared vision for the future. And, you know, I do think at Duke, the president's commitment to alumni engagement is probably something that's very, very unique. Our president has named alumni engagement as one of his core priorities. I mean, this is, you know, we're talking about like, cancer research, alumni engagement on the same level, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, so I think that has been huge in terms of helping the whole university kind of understand the value that alumni provide to the institution. And, you know, I've seen that vision really, you know, come to fruition in terms of the new lifelong learning programs, the growth in that area, the growth in the careers and mentoring. You know, we're really talking about as an institution, how do we reimagine the Duke experience so that, you know, you're admitted to Duke for a lifetime and not just for, you know, the 2, 4, 6, you know, 8 years in the case of some religion PhDs, you know, that you're a student, you're a Duke student for your entire life. And yeah, I mean, that's just having that kind of, you know, moonshot mindset has been really critical.
What was the document that you helped write for the president? It was about alumni engagement, right? It was kind of like on the news.
Yeah. So we had, that was one of the coolest experiences of my career was to be the staff lead for the Board of Trustees Task Force on activating the Global Network.
AGN, activating the Global Network. Yeah. In that document, you quoted him or you used, you from an interview with him, you talked about, excuse me, how he used the concept of a medieval guild to think about you're being part of a trade. You come as a student, you're the apprentice learning while you're at school, but you're always part of it as a master later on helping others. And it came out in the strategic plan, the second strategic plan we did, we talked about lifelong learning and two of my favorite all-time strategies ever in a document where you guys included in there was bring the intellectual firepower of Duke to our alumni. Mm-hmm. And then the next one right after is bring the intellectual firepower of our alumni to Duke. And that was brilliant. I love that concept.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you should mention the guild thing because I was actually just thinking about that today because I, as I mentioned, I'm in Denmark and I just went to the Danish Architecture Center this morning and I saw this photo of a Viking longship and then they had the Viking house right and next to it. And the house looks like if you've ever seen one, if I was adept at sharing screen on this thing, I would share it, but it looks like an upside down Viking ship, right? And so they built their houses on land. They resembled the ships. They had the same structure as the ship. And because that was considered like safer and more comfortable, right, for the time that they were on land. And I thought like, how do we, it made me think about the alumni experience because like, how do we build that, you know, Viking ship on land that makes everybody feel like this is familiar. This is like, you know, your home, this is, you know, a familiar space. And how do we make it feel, how do we make that alumni experience feel, you know, like you're still part of that, that university community.
Yeah. I love it. The next question on our script here is where do you look for inspiration in our space? And you go in the mornings for a walk to the Danish Architecture Center. And
we just heard it. Yeah.
Pop by and learn a little about Viking architecture. Right?
Yeah. Well, I think, I don't know. I mean, I'm always, I feel like I'm always learning. I genuinely, I just really enjoy being a full observer of everything all the time. And I'm a big reader. And so I'm always reading, you know, in our field and kind of reading about, reading about strategy and design thinking and higher ed innovation and that kind of stuff. But I also derive just as much inspiration from, you know, walking and art exhibitions and things like that. But I just, yeah, inspiration is everywhere. It sounds cliche, but it's true.
I thought it would be fun as sort of before we get to our Friday cheer section to give you a little quick fire set of questions. Okay. All right. You ready?
Yeah.
So most interesting and enduring quirk you've noticed about the Brits. I know your husband is British, and so I feel like you probably sorted this one out.
Yeah, this one was a hard one for me. It's a hard question for me to think about because a lot of the quirks that, you know, when you're married to somebody or when you're together with somebody for 20 years, like things either are very endearing or they're not very endearing anymore. And so I think one of the things that I think is adorable and hilarious about British people is that they can form a line or a queue, as they call it, anywhere. I mean, if there's a mass of people and they're slightly disorganized in any way, like Brits will like naturally form a line. It can be in traffic. It can be, you know, waiting for a train. It can be, but it's always very orderly, and there's a definite culture to it. And, you know, I noticed it when I was in France recently, cause there were a lot of British people and they were all like complaining about how the French people didn't respect the line. And I was like, well, there's not really a line. It's just, you know, but anyway, it's just, they can be relied upon to form a queue anywhere, anytime, for anything. So
that's a good one. Food item you most miss from the U.S.?
Oh, from the U.S. I don't know. I have to think about this one. I do have my things that I always get when I go back. Like there's the pizza place in Chapel Hill that we used to go to every single Friday as a family. And that's probably what I miss the most. You can get good pizza anywhere.
Great food in the UK, yeah.
Yeah, but that's what I miss the most.
How about food item you most miss from living in South Korea?
Oh, that's a good question too. Well, I miss like super spicy food overall. My kids say that I have a problem. They say my taste buds are dead, but I love really spicy food. And there's a Korean, like the Koreans just do these like wintry, bubbly stews very well. And so I really miss, there's one stew called sundubujjigae, which is soft tofu stew, which probably sounds, you know, not that great if you're hearing about it for the first time, but it's delicious. And it's just the perfect thing to eat when the weather's disgusting.
All right, last one for those who are trying to head to London. Most tourist destination that anyone should visit while visiting London.
Okay, so my top tip there is I think if you stand in the middle of the Waterloo Bridge, it's probably the best view in London. Off to one side, you can see the Houses of Parliament and Big Ben and off and the London Eye and everything. And then you turn the other direction, you can see St. Paul's and the Tate Modern and the OXO Tower. And it takes my breath away every time I cross that bridge, and I probably cross it at least once a week. So it never gets old.
I've seen that view. I've gone up in the London Eye, and that is right on point. I thought it was definitely amazing. Yeah. All right, so Friday cheers section, Nicole, we try to have end our shows with some points of emphasis that maybe aren't advancement related, maybe they are, something that we're thinking about. What are you thinking about? What's your Friday cheers?
Well, my Friday cheers actually has nothing to do with advancement. It's just a book recommendation. I highly recommend Richard Osman's Thursday Murder Club series. I think a lot of people who are listening into this probably travel a lot for work, and you're on plane rides or you're in the car or whatever. And it's just, Richard Osman is so funny. He's a British comedian, and he wrote this series that is about some old age pensioners who live in a retirement community, and they solve murders and hilarity ensues. And so I had avoided it because I thought it was like going to be a grisly murder mystery kind of thing. And I'm a real noodle when it comes to that stuff, but my mom recommended it to me, and it's just brilliant. And I listen to it when I'm out walking around or running with my headphones. And I think people think I'm deranged because I have been like giggling out loud while walking down the street. So
wrote that down. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Chris, how about you?
So I'm going to go to a book as well that Nicole mentioned to me during our change management meetings. I don't know if you remember saying this to me, but you said Blue Sky Thinking was the book that sort of changed your way of thinking about creating new ideas, and recommended it back then. And you're the pro here, Nicole. Tell the group what you said to me. I don't know if you remember specifically, but generally speaking, of why Blue Sky Thinking is the place to get the ideas generated and going.
Oh yeah. So Blue Ocean Strategy. That's the one and it's one of my favorite books. And yeah, it's basically like the concept is that in a lot of cases we try to fight it out in the red ocean, which is where all the competition is and everybody's kind of fighting over the same thing. And there's this whole world over here of unexploited opportunities, the blue ocean, which is where we ultimately want to get to. And I think for alumni engagement, it's such a cool concept because we often overlook populations like graduate school alumni, for example, right? And we don't think about like how to engage them. We just think about how do we engage the same volunteers that we've always been engaging. So I love that book. I think it's really makes you think differently.
Awesome. That's great. Well, I'll bring things home. My Friday Cheers, a colleague of ours, we're actually in two shows from now, we're interviewing Andrew Gosen at Cornell University. Ashley Budd is one of his direct reports, but she's really a force to be reckoned with in our space in the area of advancement, marketing and communications. She has got a book that's coming out soon called, I think she's calling it The Email Book. She's a real specialist on making email cool again, which I really appreciate. And I did her awesome online course, which was about sort of advanced marketing for an email communications. But she recommended a book during that, and I bought it. And it's called Nicely Said, Writing for the Web with Style and Purpose. And I often write for the web, and I feel it often lacks style and purpose. So I've picked it up. I'm about halfway through. It's by Nicole Fenton and Kate Kiefers-Lee. And I really enjoyed it and have picked up some good tips already. So definitely check out Ashley Budd and her partner, Day Kabild's great course on advancement email communications, and pick up Nicely Said as well.
Ryan, we'll put the names of these books and links to them in our description on the podcast. So if people want to go back and find them, we'll click a link.
I'll put them in the show notes. Absolutely. All right. Well,
thank you so much. It was so much fun. Appreciate you doing this.
Yeah. Nice to be with you too.
And glad you're part of the team. Chris, enjoy Orlando, Alumni Weekend. Enjoy Disney over spring break and the lines and such. It'll be fun. And we'll see everybody back in 2 weeks. So take care. Bye.
Bye.